Israeli forces are accused of killing one journalist and wounding six others.
We condemn Issam's killing, and we call on Israel to explain how this could have happened.
Plus, it's the first night of Hanukkah in Israel, but the celebrations are different this year.
It's not only the hostages. There are still 138 hostages. It's also the fact that hundreds of thousands of Israeli reserve soldiers have been called up. You know, fathers, men well into their 30s.
And later, frustration in the West Bank amid violent attacks from Israeli settlers, and frustration in Kyiv as U.S. senators fail to advance an aid bill. Today is Thursday, December 7th, and this is VOA's Flashpoint Global Crises. Good evening, I'm Steve Karish in Washington. Israel is accused of killing one journalist and wounding six others as they were filming along the Israel-Lebanon border. Elon Levy, an Israeli government spokesperson, said on Thursday he was not aware of investigators' findings that Israeli tank fire had killed Reuters journalist Issam Abdallah and wounded six others in Lebanon, but he denied Israeli forces targeted non-combatants.
I'm not familiar with these specific reports, but of course the guiding principle of Israel's campaign against Hamas is that we uphold the principles of international law regarding proportionality, necessity, distinction. We target Hamas, we do not target civilians, and we've been doing everything possible to get civilians out of harm's way while we go after the terror monsters who perpetrated the October 7th massacre.
The strikes on October 13th killed Abdallah and severely wounded Agence France-Presse photographer Christina Assi, just over a kilometer from the Israeli border near the Lebanese village of Alma al-Chab. A Reuters investigation has found that it was an Israeli tank crew that fired the shots from Israel that killed Abdallah and wounded the other journalists while they were filming cross-border shelling. Reuters presented the Israel Defense Force with its findings that the tank rounds were fired from within Israel and posed additional detailed questions, including whether Israeli troops knew they were firing upon journalists. Alessandra Galani is Reuters editor-in-chief.
The evidence we now have, and that we published today, is that an Israeli tank crew killed our colleague, Issam Abdallah. We condemn Issam's killing, and we call on Israel to explain how this could have happened, and to hold to account those responsible for his death and for the wounding of our colleagues, Thayer al-Sudani and Maher Nazeh. Issam was a brilliant and passionate journalist who was much loved in this newsroom. At Reuters, we report the news of the world with accuracy, integrity, independence, and freedom from bias. It is critically important that our journalists are able to do so safely.
The group of seven reporters from AFP, Al Jazeera, and Reuters were all wearing blue flak jackets and helmets, most with the word press written on them in white letters. There were journalists from at least seven other media outlets in the area that day. Meanwhile, Israeli forces said on Wednesday that they were encircling the Gaza house of top Hamas leader Yahya Sinwar as they advanced for the first time to the heart of the biggest city in the enclave south. All this while UN Secretary General invoked a rare diplomatic move to push for a ceasefire. Reuters' Diane Toh reports.
In a statement on Wednesday evening, Israel's military said its troops were carrying out, quote, target raids in central Khan Yunis for the first time. It also released footage said to show its operations there, though Reuters was not able to independently verify the location or when it was filmed. In a video message, Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu said Israeli forces had encircled the house of Hamas leader Yahya al-Sinwar in the city.
His house may not be his fortress and he can escape, but it's only a matter of time before we get him.
Meanwhile, the situation is getting increasingly difficult for civilians. Tragic scenes like this one continue to emerge, with these children sobbing after their father was wounded when Israeli forces bombed a school in eastern Khan Yunis. Gaza's health ministry has said more than 16,000 have died in the war, while local medics said hospitals were overflowing with the dead and wounded. About 8 miles south of Khan Yunis, tens of thousands have been cramming into the city of Rafah on the border with Egypt after Israeli forces told them they would be safe there. But a house was struck on Wednesday, killing at least 15 people, according to Rafah officials. Hundreds of thousands of people displaced from North Gaza by the war are desperately seeking shelter, while the number of places in the south marked as safe by Israel shrinks. On Wednesday, United Nations Secretary General Antonio Guterres made a rare move to formally warn the Security Council of a global threat from the Gaza war. He invoked a special UN rule to push for a ceasefire in a letter to the Council, saying the enclave faces, quote, a severe risk of collapse of the humanitarian system. The United Arab Emirates drafted a resolution to the Council demanding an immediate humanitarian ceasefire with a vote sought on Friday. But the United States, one of five veto powers on the 15-member Council, is opposed to a ceasefire, saying it would only benefit Hamas.
That's Diane Toe of Reuters reporting for us today. Further north from Gaza, violence by Israeli settlers in the West Bank has escalated since the war with Hamas began. This has happened even as the Biden administration steps up pressure on Israel to stop settler violence by ordering a U.S. travel ban on extremist settlers involved in the attacks. Henry Wilkins visited the scene of some of the recent clashes and has this report from the Palestinian town of Kirat Bnei Hassan in the West Bank.
In the olive groves of Hawat Bani Hassan in the West Bank, Palestinian villagers escorted VOA to the spot where Ahmed Assi, a 41-year-old father of six, was killed during clashes with Israeli settlers just 3 days earlier. After the fighting died down, his brother says villagers found his car abandoned in the middle of the road. He says someone from the town spotted his car in the location where the clashes occurred, so those who had been with him went down to search for him in the last place they saw him. He says that's where they found him dead, estimating it must have been about 4 hours earlier. The settlers came from a settlement across the valley. On a map in his office, the mayor of Hawat Bani Hassan points to Israeli settlements surrounding his community. Ibrahim Arsi says another member of the community was killed by settlers in February, but they've exhausted ways to seek justice for that killing with the Palestinian or Israeli authorities. The mayor told VOA he calls on all citizens worldwide, especially those from America and Britain, to intervene and prevent Israel from perpetrating massacres and hold them accountable for the actions of its settlers under its protection, adding that the settlers target those who lack any way to protect their lands. In recent weeks, the Biden administration has been putting pressure on Israel to stop the violence by Israeli settlers against Palestinians. On December 5th, the US announced it would ban extremist settlers from obtaining US visas, following repeated requests to the Israeli government to control the violence. In the cycle of violence, 31 Israelis, including children, have been killed in the West Bank by Palestinians this year, according to UN data. Rights groups say fatalities caused by Israeli settlers have doubled since the war began, and that settlers are better armed and more aggressive. Bill Van Esveld is a researcher for Human Rights Watch.
In previous problems with settlers, there would be one guy with a handgun, but now there's a group of guys and they all have M16s. And that the threats are much more severe and immediate, like you need to get out of your house and leave your community within 5 days.
In a written response to VOA, the Israel Defense Forces officials said the IDF and civil administration are taking all necessary actions to maintain the security of all residents in the towns and villages in the region. The IDF said it broke up the clash that killed Arsi, but the local mayor said the IDF was supporting the settlers only. As for Arsi's oldest son, aged 15, he says he couldn't believe his father was dead when he learned the news. He says the settlers made him take the burden of responsibility for his family at such a young age. The Regional Council of Israeli Settlers did not respond to VOA's request for comment. Henry Wilkins, VOA News, Harat Bani Hassan in the West Bank.
Thursday night is the first night of the Jewish holiday of Hanukkah, typically a time for joy, celebration, and family. But with so many families in Israel separated this year, how are things different? I spoke with VOA's Linda Gradstein in Jerusalem.
I think the mood is pretty somber. It's not only the hostages. There are still 138 hostages. It's also the fact that hundreds of thousands of Israeli reserve soldiers have been called up, you know, fathers, men and well into their 30s. A lot of people aren't home as well. But I think it's also kind of a hopeful time. The whole idea of Hanukkah is the historical, you know, background is of Jews triumphing over their enemies and bringing light into the world. Every night you add another candle on the menorah. So you start with one tonight and you go up to eight on the last night. So there's this idea of light kind of banishing the darkness at the darkest day of the darkest time of the year. So I think there's also kind of that feeling. And Hanukkah is also all about food, any food fried in oil. In Israel, it's more about donuts, sufganiyot, which are, of course, also fried in oil. And every year, the concoctions get more and more elaborate. And one of the bakeries called Cafe Kadosh, where people line up over an hour to buy these donuts, she's actually doing, Karen Kadosh, the baker, is doing an army-themed array of donuts where the fillings match the different berets of the different units in the Israeli army.
It's interesting you brought up the military history of Hanukkah. Another way to read that is a small underdog force of guerrillas occupied by a much larger, much more technically advanced Greek army. Is there any inspiration for the Palestinians in the story of Hanukkah?
Oh, that's an interesting question. I don't know, because I think also, you know, the Palestinians and Hamas are sort of two different things. I tend to think that Palestinians are not really looking to the Hanukkah story, which I think is more of a Jewish story.
Linda Gradstein reports for VOA from Jerusalem. Linda, thanks for your time. Thanks for your reporting on these topics.
Thank you very much.
More now on families. As Israel's war in Gaza rages on, the families who still have loved ones being held hostage in Gaza continue to wait for any word or any sign of life from their loved ones. But there is little information on where they are and how they're doing. Lori London spoke with Shai Wenkert, whose 22-year-old son is one of those hostages.
My understanding is your 22-year-old son, Omer, was at the music festival and taken hostage, and he also suffers from a chronic medical condition. What can you tell us about that and what happened?
Omer was kidnapped by the Hamas from the music fest. He was at the shelter for about 1.5 hours until he went out. He just said that he don't want to die inside. There was a gun shooting and there were hand grenades thrown inside and burning inside the shelter. Something that the smoke went inside. And the last sentence that he sent us on the WhatsApp, it's, "I'm frightened." And then he went out from the shelter. When he went out, the Hamas terrorists kidnapped him.
And it looks like you found out through a video of him in the back of some sort of vehicle.
We found out at noon, after a few hours, that we are trying to connect with him, trying to look for him at videos from the Facebook or on any media. And a friend called me and he told me that Omer is alive. I have a video, but he probably not in our hands. This was terrifying to see my son, that he was brutally beaten and kidnapped to the Gaza Strip with the SUV of the Hamas. You can see him beating and kissing him. He's only with underwear, with handcuff. And we have also a photo that also published by the Telegram of the Hamas, that he's only with underwear, his hand under his back, and he's lying on the sandbags. It's supposed to go to the Palestinian refugees, but the Hamas always probably took it for their own cause.
I'm sure that was very painful to see. Did it at least give you some relief that he was alive?
I don't know if I can say at the same moment on the 7th of October, yes. But I thought he's staying alone and I didn't know the real situation. It was horrible to think about it. I tried to call many, many people to reach out for any assistance. maybe they can do. And unfortunately, he was already in Gaza Strip, and to go inside, it's impossible for civilians. Yeah, I saw my son alive, and I know he's alive. And 2 days later, an officer from the IDF came to us to inform us that he's captive by the Hamas, and that's it. And since then, over 60 days that we don't know nothing, and nothing is going towards.
You've heard nothing about his condition or his whereabouts at all?
No, nothing at all, nothing.
And he does have some chronic health issues. I'm sure that that's also weighing on you.
Yeah, he has a colitis disease. It's a chronic disease. In a situation of stress and bad condition, it's getting severe. It's getting very painful in the stomach. It's getting diarrhea every couple of hours. He needs his medicine. He needs a medical aid. It's very difficult to think about it that he's not getting any medical aid. I don't know. I don't know if it's okay. I don't know if he has water, if he sleeps, if he eats, because we heard the evidence of released hostages that they describe it that worst case to be there. It's worse condition. So they need to take them out. They have to take them all out and the sick people first because they have no other day to stay there.
What would you like the government to do?
I think the government are doing the best. I don't think no one has this situation in the past. It's very difficult. I believe they will do more agreement to take all the hostages out. This is not what I want for them. I want them to do an effort, a massive effort with all the countries that are speaking with, also with the support of the USA, support us a lot for the negotiation, with also with Qatar and Egypt. They need to take all hostages out.
I'm sure it's especially painful for those of you with family members like your son, Omar, who is a male, and women and children being released, although that seems to have come to a stall with the war now escalating.
Oh, from the evidence that we had, I heard today, one of the hostages that released, she is a woman and she was released with to her children, but her husband was over there with her. And she described awful things that even the men can't stay there. It's horrible to be there. Very horrible to be there. I have to take them all out. They are not surviving. I don't want to think that my son will be back as a body.
What was she saying?
He described that he's in a very bad condition, that he is also wounded and there is no medical aid and he suffers a lot.
And she just described the situation as unsustainable.
Unsustainable and no one can stay there.
Tell us about Omar. What do you want people to know about him?
Omar is 22 years old. He's my oldest son. I miss him a lot. Every day it's getting even difficult, more difficult. He's a very kind and very happy boy. He's only a boy, he's 22 years old. He likes music, he likes foodies, he likes restaurants, he's also a manager of a big restaurant. He wants to learn about the managing of a restaurant. This is the career that he wants to do. He has a lot of friends, all kind of friends. Everybody loves him. Everybody wants to be next to him. He's like a human magnet. He's very smiling, very handsome guy. He was also at youth group when he was a child. Everybody loves him. Everybody loves him.
That's Lori London, host of VOA's International Edition, speaking with Shai Wenkert, father of a 22-year-old hostage. You're listening to Flashpoint Global Crises from the Voice of America. I'm Steve Karish in Washington. An update from Kyiv in a moment. First, though, an update on a story we brought you on Wednesday's program. Legislation that would provide new security assistance for Ukraine and Israel was blocked in the U.S. Senate on Wednesday as Republicans demanded tougher measures to control immigration at the U.S. border with Mexico. Reuters' Ryan Chang has that story.
The U.S. Senate blocked an emergency spending bill on Wednesday, which would have provided billions of dollars in new security assistance for Ukraine and Israel. That's as Republicans insisted on tougher measures and more money to control immigration. Senate Republican leader Mitch McConnell said in a floor speech on Wednesday that Senate should, quote, start meeting America's national security priorities, including right here at home, referring to the illegal immigration at the U.S. border with Mexico. The bill, which includes $20 billion for border security, provides about $50 billion in new security assistance for Ukraine, as well as money for humanitarian and economic aid for the government in Kyiv, plus $14 billion for Israel. The final tally of votes was 49 in favor to 51 against, short of the 60 votes needed to start debate. Every Senate Republican voted no, along with Senator Bernie Sanders, an independent who expressed concerns about funding Israel's, quote, current inhumane military strategy. Senate Majority Leader Chuck Schumer, a Democrat, also voted no so that he could introduce the measure again in the future. The stalemate in negotiations about Ukraine and Israel funding has been going on for weeks. On Wednesday, Biden warned that a victory for Russia in Ukraine would put Moscow in a position to attack NATO allies and draw U.S. troops into war.
If Putin takes Ukraine, he won't stop there. It's important to see the long run here. He's going to keep going. History's going to judge harshly those who turn their back on freedom's cause. We can't let Putin win.
On the streets of Kyiv on Wednesday, residents said they were worried and already felt the pain from delays in Western military aid.
We already feel it. A friend of mine recently died fighting. We need to get the help as soon as possible. Every day of delay means loss of human lives. Yes, thanks to our partners, our defense is holding up. But regarding this issue, the congressmen need to speed up their actions because we all understand that we have less manpower than Russia.
Congress has approved more than $110 billion for Ukraine since Russia's February 2022 invasion, but it has not approved any funds since Republicans took over the House from Democrats in January. Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky's chief of staff said on Tuesday, postponing U.S. assistance for Kyiv would create a big risk of Ukraine losing the war with Russia. Ukraine conducted a major counteroffensive push this year, but was unable to break through Russian defensive lines. Russia is now on the offensive in the east.
That's Reuters' Ryan Chang reporting for us. And as the standoff continues in Washington, drone attacks continue in Ukraine. Meanwhile, a former member of the Parliament of Ukraine was found dead in Russia. Anna Chernikova in Kyiv has the details.
In the early hours of December 7th, Russian forces attacked Ukraine with drones targeting the Khmelnytskyi and Odessa regions. Ukrainian air defense destroyed 15 of 18 of the drones. However, one driver was killed in Odessa, where a warehouse, elevator, and trucks were damaged by the strike. No casualties or damage have been reported in the Khmelnytskyi region. On Wednesday, Ukrainian and Russian media sources reported the murder of Ilya Kiva, a former member of the Parliament of Ukraine. In Ukraine, Kiva, believed to be an agent of the Russian Special Service and an ally of Viktor Medvedchuk, President Putin's business partner. He was accused of treason, war propaganda, encroachment on territorial integrity, calls for the seizure of state power, and the spread of communist symbols. He left Ukraine before the beginning of Russia's full-scale invasion. In March 2022, the Ukrainian parliament expelled him. Andriy Yusov, a representative of the Ukrainian intelligence service, told Radio Liberty that Kiva was killed in Russia. The investigative committee of Russia also confirmed Kiva's death and opened a criminal murder case. Ukrainian media report that the Ukrainian security service is responsible for killing Kiva, according to anonymous internal sources. VOA cannot verify this information independently. Meanwhile, the mood is anxious in Ukraine as the U.S. Senate failed to approve a draft bill on providing Ukraine and Israel with new financial assistance for security needs on Wednesday. Anna Chernikova, VOA News, Kyiv.
And that's going to wrap up today's show. There is more VOA coverage 24 hours a day on our website, voanews.com, and across our social media platforms. On behalf of everyone here at VOA, thanks for listening. Until tomorrow, I'm Steve Karish.
Stay up to date with VOA podcasts. Each weekday, International Edition covers the world's biggest stories, while Flashpoint Iran and Flashpoint Ukraine examine their respective regions in depth every week.